Great. Well, hello, everyone. Thank you, Han, for that kind introduction, and thank you to the Perimeter Institute for having me. So today, I'll be talking about the future of numerical relativity, more specifically, gravitational memory effects, BMS frames, and some more recent developments that I personally find somewhat exciting. So the rough outline of this talk will be the following. I'll kind of open up by presenting what gravitational memory is from a numerical perspective. And then we'll kind of dive into where memory arises in this BMS charge flux prescription, which turns out to be incredibly useful because memory is intimately related to these asymptotic symmetries. What's also nice about this BMS charge and flux prescription is it's really useful for numerical relativity and kind of just understanding the physics that's occurring in the radiation we see emitted from our simulations. Following this, I'll then kind of get into a little bit more detail about how we produce these waveforms from our simulation and highlight what new techniques have arisen that allow us to more accurately extract waveforms to resolve these memory effects and some other interesting features. And then following this, I'll discuss how these BMS frames, named after Bondi, Vandenberg, Metzner, and Sachs, are important for numerical relativity and kind of outline how we can use this BMS charge and flux prescription to fix the BMS frame of our numerical waveforms, which turns out to be incredibly important for comparing to the models produced by black hole perturbation theory, namely quasi-normal modes, or comparing your numerical waveforms to post-Newtonian theory during the early in-spiral of the binary merger. OK, but since this is a talk on gravitational waves, let's start by just kind of looking at what a gravitational wave is. So here I have a numerical simulation for a binary which corresponds to the likely parameters for 1509-14, the first observation by LIGO. On the horizontal axis, I just have the time. And on the vertical axis, I just have the plus polarization of the strain. And so I've labeled this as the past because this is a simulation done many years ago. And it's kind of a somewhat outdated view of gravitational waves, namely because this picture is just absolutely wrong. So if anybody shows you a picture of a gravitational wave that looks like this, raise your hand and say, Keith taught me that gravitational waves don't look like this. They actually look like this. And so this is the future of numerical relativity. This is what we can do nowadays with our improved techniques. And so what you should notice is that while the oscillatory parts of these two waveforms are essentially the same, there's one key difference in the new one, which I've highlighted in red. And specifically, it's this memory effect. Here I'm showing what's called the displacement memory, but I'll get into a bit more detail about what the various types of memory effects are that we can resolve and kind of what their physical interpretations are. But to really understand what memory is, the most useful way to kind of analyze it is through the lens of the BMS group, which was developed by Bondi, Vandenberg, Metzner, and Sachs in the early 1960s. So the BMS group turns out to be one possible symmetry group for the symmetries at asymptotic infinity. And so the way you can kind of derive what this BMS group is you start with this equivalence class of vector fields that satisfy Killing's equation approximately with respect to the falloff conditions as you approach future null infinity. And so if you work through the nitty-gritty details like Bondi, Vandenberg, Metzner, and Sachs did, what you discover is the following vector field. And this vector field can really be understood in terms of two parameters. This parameter alpha, which is called the supertranslation parameter, and this vector y, which when written in terms of its electric and magnetic components, just correspond to Poincaré boosts and Poincaré rotations. And so here I'm just considering the BMS group. I'm not considering possible modifications where you include what are called super rotations or super boosts, or even possible the abilities like the Weyl group. Here I'm just considering the normal BMS group where we have Poincaré plus super rotations. And so an easier way that I like to think of the BMS group is instead through the following picture. So instead, you can imagine you have some group of observers surrounding some kind of event, say a binary black hole merger. And if they're at some finite radius from this event, and they have a reasonable understanding of where they're positioned relative to one another, then they could come up with some kind of scheme where they could change their personal watches such that they receive the same information from this event at the same time. But if we push these observers to asymptotic infinity, then performing this clock synchronization becomes impossible, which means we can freely time translate each of these observers without changing the underlying physics. And so these super translations are exactly that. they're these direction-dependent time translations. And that can kind of be seen here through this parameter alpha, because it's some arbitrary function on the two-sphere, and it appears in front of this retarded time derivative, which should be indicative of the fact that this really is just some direction-dependent time translation. Okay, but what's so special about additional symmetries thanks to the BMS group is that for each of these new symmetries, we should expect a different kind of BMS balance law thanks to Noether's theorem. And so these BMS balance laws should really relate some kind of charge and some kind of flux that are related to these symmetries. So it turns out that for each of these infinite number of symmetries, there's actually many different choices of charges that you can make. And so for the purposes of this talk, the charges that I'm going to use are those that were originally developed by Dre and Stroebel and later independently realized by Wald and Zupas. And the reason I picked these charges is that they have a couple of nice properties. The main ones are that when you choose these charges, you end up with no fluxes in Minkowski space, and the charge which corresponds to supertranslations, the supermomentum, turns out to be real value. And so these charges, the charge that corresponds to the supertranslation is just the usual Bonnie mass aspect, and the charges corresponding to the Lorentz symmetries is just this Lorentz aspect n. And this, usually it's just actually this first Weyl scalar, but there's this extra term of sigma f sigma bar, which is this term introduced by Wald and Zupas. Okay, so if you have these charges, then what you can do is you can look at the metric which describes asymptotic radiation, namely the Bondi-Sachs metric. You can identify these charges inside certain metric functions when you expand them in terms of 1 over r. And if you work out Einstein's equations, then you obtain these evolution equations for these charges, which when integrated yield these balance laws. And so the balance laws state the following. They say that the real part of the shear, really this is an F bar squared shear, where this F is this spin weight operator. So it changes the spin weight of the shear from being spin weight 2 to spin weight 0. But so it says the real part of this quantity is equal to a mass charge plus an energy flux. And it also says that the imaginary part of this quantity is equal to this retarded time derivative, which is important, acting on this Lorentz charge and this Lorentz flux. And so what's particularly nice about these balance laws is because of the way these spin weight operators F act, they actually annihilate the L equals 0 and L equals 1 harmonics. So if you look at these balance laws for the L equals 0 and L equals 1 modes, what they reduce to is just this left-hand side is going to be 0, and you recover the normal Poincaré balance laws. Namely, you know, a change in mass is balanced by an energy flux, etc. What's interesting, though, is if you look at the higher order harmonics, namely L equals 2 and larger, then you have this description which says that your shear radiated by your system can effectively be thought of as coming from some charge contribution, such as the mass charge, and some flux contribution, such as the pointer. Oh, you can't really see it? Here, I can grab the hockey stick instead. So this is just saying, right, that your shear can be understood in terms of some charge and some flux, which is somewhat useful for understanding kind of the physics taking place. For example, we can look at the shear emitted in our numerical simulations and try to understand it in terms of these charges and fluxes. So here I'm showing the 2-2 harmonic of the shear. And for those of you who may not be aware, this is typically the dominant mode that's emitted by binary black hole mergers. And this is often pretty much the only thing that LIGO sees. And so in gray, I have the shear.
Just forget it, 2-2 means Lm.
Right, L is 2, M is 2, exactly. So here, the shear is shown in gray. The mass charge is shown in black. And all of the other charges and fluxes end up being approximately 0 for this mode. And this really shouldn't be too much of a surprise, because the mass charge here effectively corresponds to the mass multiple moment. So if we're looking at the dominant harmonic of our gravitational radiation, we would expect it to be sourced by the mass multiple moment, which is effectively all this plot is saying. If we want to look at something which is sourced by the Lorentz charge, we can just look at a harmonic which has what's called magnetic parity, so something with an odd M mode, such as the 2-1 mode. And so if we look at the 2-1 mode, we see something very similar, namely the shear represented in gray is almost entirely sourced by the Lorentz charge, which you can think of as just being the current multiple moment. So really, there's nothing too interesting going on here. It's just saying that your shear really is predominantly sourced by the mass and the current multiple moments, which is kind of what we expect from PM theory. Okay. Now, what gets interesting is so far we've really only been looking at these balance laws as a function of time. But instead, you can also think of them as some net change over time, namely looking at the value at late times and comparing it to the value at early times. And the reason that's particularly interesting is because since the shear shows up on the left-hand side of these equations, if we look at their net change over time, this effectively corresponds to these memory effects, because the memory is just a net change in the shear over time. And so if we do that, you kind of immediately have this nice decomposition of the most important types of memory into their different components. So there's kind of a lot going on in this table. There's actually a lot more memory effects than the ones I've written here, but these are kind of the ones that are going to be important for this talk. So it turns out that there's different ways you can see the memory. You can see the memory in the real part of the strain, given by this equation, or you can see it in the imaginary part of the strain. And you saw earlier that the balance law for the imaginary part of the strain had that retarded time derivative out front. So it turns out that if you look for memory in the imaginary part, you actually have to look in the integral of the shear, which is given by that second equation. Now, because there's these four different terms on the right-hand side, namely the mass, energy, angular momentum aspect, and angular momentum flux, we typically like to think of the memory that's sourced by each one of these independent observables. And so if the memory is sourced by one of these aspects, namely the Bondi mass aspect or the Lorentz aspect, this is called ordinary memory, or what was previously called linear. And this is typically sourced by systems which have unbound masses. So if you have some kind of hyperbolic black hole scattering, then the memory you see from this type of system is predominantly going to arise in the charge terms, such as the mass charge and the Lorentz charge. The memory sourced by these flux terms, namely the energy flux and the Lorentz flux, is what we call null or nonlinear, or some people call it Christodoulou as well. And so this is the memory that's typically going to be sourced in bound systems, such as binary black holes. And so realistically, we're probably going to see null memory before we see ordinary memory, just because we see much more binary black hole mergers than any hyperbolic encounters. And kind of the last thing that I'll say is if the memory shows up in the real part of the shear, this is what's called displacement, because it corresponds to two initially co-moving observers experiencing a permanent net displacement due to radiation. Whereas these other types of memory, center of mass and spin, these show up in the time integral of the shear. And what they physically correspond to is if your observers have some relative velocity, then they'll experience a permanent net displacement due to that relative velocity. Okay. Are there any questions on this? Yes.
Sorry, I have a question. So is the question whether you are making this as an assumption or you have some way to track it down, the fact that we are not conformal infinity with respect to the source? So here you're doing an asymptotic symmetry analysis that is asymptotic, right? Mm-hmm. The conformal infinity, right? And I think we all assume implicitly that it works for us on Earth as we make the measurement, just because we are very far from the source. But is there a way to track that effect down, or you are just assuming it?
You mean the memory effect specifically?
No, I mean in general, the fact that this analysis that you're doing, you're applying it for us as an observer on Earth, mm-hmm. and we are not where this analysis is supposed to hold. So there must be an effect that, in my opinion, is extremely small, but I'm asking you whether it has been thought of, like this effect, the fact that we are not at infinite distance.
Right, yeah. So the fact that we're not in infinity essentially should just come into the factor of how we scale the shear, right?
How we scale?
Scale, right. And so in our simulations, we scale the shear by the factor of the radius. So effectively, we factor out the radial distance and just look at the shear as it is. And so whenever I present these kind of plots, you always have to think, when we physically detect this, you have to scale by whatever distance you are from the source, which is going to suppress this effect immensely. But as long as you can detect, you know, the normal contributions to the shear, such as this oscillatory component, this memory component is essentially the exact same thing. So if you can see the oscillatory part of the shear, the memory part should also be there, but perhaps more suppressed. That makes sense.
So if I can bother you one more. Suppose now, for instance, you're observing some waves, form packet arriving a black hole, which is a distance x, and then you go and you have the same thing at a black hole, which is a distance 10,000 times x. Would you be able, in these memories, effects, etc., to tell that there is a 10 times x or not? Is this a conformal memory or is this really a memory?
This would be a real memory, right? But there might be modifications as you change that radial.
Thanks.
Yep. Okay, so this is kind of the memories we should have in mind. And if we're thinking about binary black holes, which is kind of the main observable that we see, the main contributor should be this energy flux. Because since this is a bound system, we shouldn't worry about the charges, we should really just think about the fluxes. And if you think about some binary black hole merger, right, as these binary black holes are inspiraling and eventually merge, they're emitting a massive amount of radiation, which you can think of as being essentially uniformly radiated in the azimuthal direction. And so if we think about that, then if we think of what harmonic this memory is going to arise in, it should be something that's azimuthally symmetric, such as an M equals zero mode. So since we've looked at 2-2 and 2-1, let's go ahead and look at 2-0 and see if this prediction that 2-0 should be the memory mode holds up. Well, if you take a numerical waveform from the SXS collaboration, which is my collaboration, and you plot the 2-0 mode, this is what you see. And at least to my eyes, there doesn't seem to be some permanent net change, right? It kind of looks like it's zero, it oscillates around merger, and then decays to zero again. So what's going on here, right? Where's this memory effect? Well, it's because this waveform was produced using a past version of the code. And it turns out that the past version of the code is just blatantly wrong. So the way the code worked previously is via something called extrapolation. So when we run our simulations, we run what's called a Cauchy evolution on some finite region of spacetime. So you're essentially just solving Einstein's equations for these two black holes on some finite region. Then the way you get the waveforms is you extract the metric data on a series of finite radius world tubes, you interpolate between these world tubes to obtain some dense set of data, and then you fit to that data with polynomials in 1 over r. And you say, well, as we approach infinity or as we approach LIGO, the only term that's going to matter is the 1 over r piece. And so the shear should effectively be whatever coefficient you obtain from these fits, that's the coefficient on this 1 over r piece. But what you'll notice then is all of the physics that's interesting has only been evolved inside of our outer boundary. The physics from the outer boundary to future null infinity is just approximated. There's no actual evolution going on. So kind of the obvious thing to do, which is a more correct thing to do, is to simply evolve Einstein's equations on that hypersurface that connects your world tube to asymptotic infinity. And this is called Cauchy characteristic evolution. So the way Cauchy characteristic evolution works is you take that same world tube and its derivatives on some finite radius world tube. You then connect it to asymptotic infinity using some null hypersurface. And if you are clever and pick the right initial data for that null hypersurface, then you can evolve it forward in time to obtain not only the shear, but also all of the Weyl scalars at asymptotic infinity. Now the important thing here is, well, how do you choose that initial data? And so really that initial data should depend on the entire past history of your binary. But we can't evolve a numerical simulation for an infinite amount of time. So instead what we do is we just match the shear on this null hypersurface to the world tube at this boundary as well as its derivatives, which has some problems, which I'll highlight later on. Okay, but so if we run CCE on one of our simulations and look at the 2-0 mode, we obtain the following.
Sorry, that's the matching at the cylinder, and then what you assume?
Right, so the cylinder is evolved using a Cauchy evolution, and then after that's done, as a post-processing technique, we take the world tube that's at this boundary,
okay,
build this hypersurface, and evolve it forward. So that has a problem in that there's no information going from the hypersurface back into the Cauchy evolution. This is essentially a one-way boundary condition. And so there's a modification to Cauchy characteristic evolution where you actually feed information back across. And so you do the two evolutions simultaneously. We're working on that. The code's written, but we haven't actually applied it to a black hole merger.
Okay, so you're assuming that, okay, whatever is on C might use negligible. Yeah.
Exactly. Which is a reasonable assumption.
Reasonable.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, since then we gave a talk several weeks ago about this Cauchy characteristic
space data match. Xizheng Ma, yeah, so he developed what's called the CCM code. And so it works for some simple systems, but it's only in our new code Spectre, which can't evolve binary black holes yet. So it's going to be at least another year or so until that's right. Right, so then there is the issue of the symmetries on the black hole horizon, which is something we haven't really touched yet.
Okay, yeah, I was just curious if you could say that this almost is more like that in the sense that every black hole has its own, like, matching of the look of the
two infinities, in a sense, or not. So we have thought about, well, how much should your kind of asymptotic measurement of local quantities correspond to the actual local measurements, right? Right, yeah. So we've thought about it, and initially it seems like there's pretty reasonable agreement between the two. But the problem is when you're looking at these local measurements, a lot of it is really gauge dependent. So it's kind of hard to understand what's going on. Yes?
Does what's happening in a cosmological background make any of this challenging?
So here we're just you were just doing vacuum GR, no cosmological constant.
Right. But like, with that, the we're in an expanding universe. Would that affect any of these measures at all?
Yeah. So there are modifications you obtain when you account for expansion, but they're typically pretty subdominant. So we shouldn't at our current state of our observational capabilities, those effects shouldn't necessarily be too important. OK, so we have this new code, CCE. And if we run it and look at the 2-0 harmonic, where previously we didn't see a memory effect, now we see the following. So as you can see, the shear clearly evolves from some finite value to some different finite value. And if you break it down into this BMS charge flux prescription, your mass charge is effectively what we saw earlier, right? These oscillations near merger. But now you have this massive contribution from the energy flux, which entirely sources this memory effect. So voila, the future of numerical relativity has memory effects. But not only does it have this displacement memory effect, it also has the spin memory effect. So here I'm showing the imaginary part of the 3-0 mode. And so immediately, you can see that this mode is entirely sourced by the Lorentz charge, which kind of captures these oscillations, and this Lorentz flux, which looks somewhat like a bump function. And so there's no obvious net change here in the shear, but if you remember, I said earlier, this spin memory effect shows up in the integral of the shear. And so if you imagine integrating this bump function, then you would certainly obtain a memory effect in the time integral of the shear. And so this memory effect is certainly present. It's very subdominant compared to the displacement memory effect, but there are hopes of detecting it within the nearby future, which I can talk about more at the end.
So let me ask a naive question. So the way you track the way relativity should be frame dependent, right? Like,
yes.
Whatever you observe, how do you know it's not the artifact of your frame choice?
So if you look at how the frame transforms your data, there's no transformation you can apply that would remove this effect. So effectively, right, the memory is this difference between late and early times. And so that's a physical observable that you can't cage away. You could certainly, so as we'll see with like the displacement memory effect, I can change this waveform so that instead of, you know, going to 0.1, it goes to 0. What that means is that at early times, it's going to be like negative 0.1. So that overall net change, you can't gauge away. Yes?
What about center of mass memory?
Right. So center of mass memory, like the spin memory, will be a bump function. It'll show up in the real part of the shear for this 3-0 mode. But unfortunately, it's somewhat consistent with our numerical error because it's much smaller than spin memory. So I chose not to show it just because we're not that confident in its resolution in our simulations.
Can you give the order of the
physically? Let's see, if the displacement is 10 to the negative 21.
Like, how does it compare to the displacement map?
Right, so, I mean, perhaps I can do in terms of detection. So people think we'll detect displacement in 2.5 years. Spin will be 5 to 6. And center of mass is more like upwards of 10.
Really? You're really optimistic. You are.
My 10-year clock is like...
Oh, all right, but yeah. You are saying you need
3D
detectors to detect.
Well, so the most recent analysis that was done by Alexander Grant and David Nichols, they say if you operate at LIGO 04 for 1.5 years and then 05 for an additional year, you will have the confidence to say over this many events, we've detected memory, even though you haven't seen it in an individual event. So this is called essentially stacking, and it's like building up a confidence. But for seeing it in an individual event, yeah, we'll certainly need 3G detectors.
Okay.
What type of detectors?
3G, so like Cosmic Explorer, Einstein Telescope, just the next generation of observational, gravitational detectors.
I have a question, which is extremely naive, I'm sorry.
No worries, yes.
Theoretical physics kick in, and I don't understand experiments that well. But suppose you are measuring with memories, but there are very there are events that have a lot of magnitudes, which are clearly the one we measure. And then there are supposedly, if I remember correctly, like 10 to the x more events, which are very small.
Right.
This will build up the memory. Is that more statistically relevant than the big events because they are so much more numerous? And then you cannot really test your numerical results because you don't know how many events there were.
So part of the issue with memory, right, is that it can either be an expansive or a compressive effect, right? It can be either side. And so if you treat this kind of just as a random walk problem, you know, you'll probably experience some like permanent net expansion, but then you'll probably go back to being zero. And you'll kind of just weave your way around. So in terms of detecting the overall net displacement from everything in the universe, right, what LIGO is detecting when LIGO sees memory isn't that permanent net displacement. What they're detecting is the frequency associated with the rise of the memory. So it's essentially a proxy for what the memory is. And so as numerical relativists, all we're doing is we're saying, hey, if you see this frequency, you've probably seen a memory effect. But in order to truly detect memory, what you would have to do is like take a rock, throw it into outer space that way, take a rock, throw it in outer space that way, and see if they experience some permanent net displacement. But obviously, you know, we haven't done that yet. It'll be something interesting.
Okay, so it's like all these billions of events that you don't see, they just have different frequencies, so they don't enter into your detection.
Exactly.
Okay, thanks. Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
So I understand that there are many groups still doing the first, using the first method of extracting.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that all those catalogs, waveforms must be redone.
Right. So at some point, we'll have to take all 3,000 simulations we've run and run CCE on them again. There are some possible quick fixes. So because this energy flux only depends on the news, it turns out you can just take the waveforms you have, compute what this energy flux term should be, and then add it back on. And so this is kind of currently how people come up with these estimates for detecting memory, is they compute what the memory should be, and then kind of go from there. So that's what groups who currently just do extrapolation can do. And it's a decent prediction, but it's not, you know, as perfect as this. Yeah,
that was my second question. How well do you approximate this effect with analytical methods?
Right, yeah, so if you use the analytical methods and you use all the other modes in the waveform, the agreement between this memory and the memory you get from that expression is like less than 1% in terms of relative error. So they're very close to each other. Yes?
So like, you could probably imagine this, you should throw a rock this way and throw a rock that way. Ideally, that's not exactly what Lisa's doing.
Right, so Lisa is particularly interesting because Lisa is truly free falling. So the mirrors themselves will experience these permanent net displacements. And so I don't think there's been enough work in the LISA community to really understand how prominent this effect is going to be. This is kind of a joke that I like to think about, but if you kind of think of this memory as a random walk problem, then over time you could think of it as just totally disrupting the satellites and now everything is broken. Realistically, that probably won't happen because these effects are too small, but this is something, right, that the LISA community will have. Okay, everyone clear so far? Well, so I've shown you these, but there's not necessarily any reason you should believe me, right? In the past, I've shown you waveforms without memory and people have taken it to be truth. So why should we believe that this is correct? Well, one thing we can do is we can compare to analytical models, such as post-Newtonian theory. And so if we take our waveform and we compare to the PN prediction of a 2-0 mode, what we obtain is the following. So NR is in black and PN is in blue. And so the two are clearly different, right? So what's going on here? Well, part of the problem stems from this fact that we have to do some kind of initialization for that first null hypersurface. And when we do that, we aren't accounting for the entire past history of our spacetime, whereas PN theory does. So this is kind of the immediate problem, because we're really just using the initial data of our Cauchy evolution, which is somewhat naive. So in an ideal world, we would initialize that first null hypersurface just using a PN metric. This is something we want to try, but we haven't tried yet, because it turns out that there's a somewhat nice workaround. And so to understand this workaround, I want to step away from PN and instead think about black hole perturbation theory. So as we know, whenever you have a black hole that's formed from either a collapse or a binary black hole merger, it's going to ring down to a state of equilibrium. And that ringing is fairly well approximated by first-order black hole perturbation theory, which produces these solutions known as quasi-normal modes, or QNMs. And so these QNMs are just a sum over damped sinusoids. For each harmonic LM, there's a corresponding overtone number, which essentially tells you how fast your solution damps. And so each solution has some amplitude, some exponential factor, which determines its frequency and damping time. And then there's these things called mixing coefficients, which take you from a spheroidal harmonic basis to a spherical harmonic basis. We can effectively just ignore those for now. And so the main thing you require from your boundary conditions is that the imaginary part of this frequency parameter is negative. And this just means that your QNM solution is going to decay to zero as your bonding time approaches infinity. Fine, OK. But as we've just kind of seen, waveforms and numerical waveforms don't decay to zero because of this memory effect. So how can we expect black hole perturbation theory to accurately model this ring down if the numerical waveform is not going to zero, but the ring down model is? And this is kind of similarly related to that PN picture. Well, let's just kind of ignore that fact for now and instead just try fitting one of these 2-0 harmonics with these QNMs. So in blue, this is the 2-0 harmonic of NR. And in orange, this is the best fit QNM model with 7 overtones. And as you can see, it really tries during the earlier parts, but then it eventually just fails because it's forced to decay to zero. So now we can ask, right, is this an issue with our numerical waveforms, with black hole perturbation theory, or something else? Well, what turns out to be happening is that the remnant formed in this simulation isn't Kerr, it's actually supertranslated Kerr. And so to account for this difference, really we have to account for the difference in BMS frames. So how might we do this? Well, if we're going to account for these BMS freedoms, we should probably first understand how they act on our data. So your typical BMS transformation is just some supertranslation alpha, which I've written in terms of complex stereographic projective coordinates. And your Lorentz transformation can effectively just be written as a Möbius transformation, where these A, B, C, and D are complex coefficients. And so your coordinates, they just transform. The bonding time picks up a conformal factor and this direction-dependent time translation. And your angular coordinates just transform via Möbius transform. If you look at how the shear transforms, then you pick up this factor of F squared alpha, which effectively is this constant shift in the modes of the shear. But there's also this important feature that you need to expand your new bonding time about the original bonding time. And so if you just do a simple Taylor expansion, what you find is that you have this additional term, which has these mixings between the supertranslation parameter and various time derivatives of the shear. So in summary, you not only have a constant change in the modes, there's also this mixing between the modes. Okay, so with this, we can think about how we're going to fix the frame. Now, since BMS is just an extension of Poincaré, we can first think about how we fix the Poincaré frame. Well, for fixing the Poincaré frame, the most natural thing is to use the charges that we developed at the start of this talk. Namely, we can construct some center of mass charge, which tells us the translation and boost that maps us to the rest frame, and a rotation charge, which we can just kind of align with the z-axis to make things simple. But how well does this work in practice? So here, this is the 2-1 harmonic of an equal mass non-spinning system. And so based on that fact that it's equal mass non-spinning, there's a degree of symmetry, so you'd actually expect the 2-1 mode to be 0. But so if you look at this mode, you know, this is scaled by 10 to the negative 6, so it's pretty small, but it's clearly not 0. And so if you look at the center of mass charge, what you find is that the x, y, and z components all have non-zero values. So it means that during your simulation, your binary is actually drifting through the space-time, some non-zero velocity. So what people have done in the past is they simply take the coordinate positions of these black holes, compute a Newtonian trajectory, and find the translation and boost which minimize that trajectory. Now there's two problems. One, it's Newtonian, and here we're clearly dealing with full nonlinear GR. And the other is that these coordinate positions are highly gauge dependent. So it'd be much better to just find the translation and boost, which minimize the center of mass charge. And so if you do that, you kind of obtain the following. So here I've changed the scale to 10 to the negative 9. The black curve is the same, now just scaled by 10 to the negative 3. The red curve is what was obtained previously. So you see, you reduce things by about 2 orders of magnitude, but the frequency is still the same. And what you find is that the frequency in the red and black curves is the same as the 2-2 harmonic. So what this means is that you're not really in the center of mass frame, because the 2-2 harmonic is leaking into the 2-1 harmonic due to this unfixed freedom in your symmetries. But if you map to this frame using the center of mass charge, then you reduce by another order of magnitude, and you recover the expected frequency of the 2-1 mode. So again, this isn't exactly zero, but our numerical simulations have some degree of error, and this is consistent now with numerical error. So there's probably just some, you know, maybe your mass ratio isn't exactly 1, so there's this symmetry breaking of the system itself.
So, sorry, you are correcting this at real time? Like,
this is post-processing. So during the simulation itself, people have tried to modify the boundary conditions to kind of restrict this center of mass drift. It's not perfect, but it does the job well enough that we can run the simulation and then correct this afterwards in our waveforms.
So, a naive question, but if you improve your initial data, this error will go down, or this is independent of your...
Yeah, this is just some issue with our outer boundary condition that we haven't really figured out yet. Okay, so what about supertranslations? Well, we should really just try to do something similar, namely using some kind of charge corresponding to supermomentum. So it turns out there's many choices for supermomentum that you can make. Dre and Stroebel figured out that the supermomentum will typically be these first two terms, which is the Bondi mass aspect, plus these two additional terms where P and Q are these free parameters. And so if you kind of work things out, you find that if P and Q are equal, then there's no supermomentum flux in Minkowski space. And if P plus Q is equal to 1, then your supermomentum is real. So kind of the natural choice is P and Q equal to a half, which yields what's known as the Dirac supermomentum. But for our purposes, it turns out that this is actually supertranslation covariant in non-radiative regimes in Scribe. So if we want to change our remnant black hole, this isn't going to tell us how to do so. Instead, kind of how you can figure out what to use is you can look at just how the shear transforms. So if you look at how the shear transforms via a supertranslation in a non-radiative regime, what you find is that the only term in this BMS balance law that changes is this energy flux. So really what we want is we want some kind of supermomentum, which changes like the energy flux. Unfortunately, this has already been found. It's called the Moresky supermomentum, and it's when P is equal to 1 and Q is equal to 0. So there's a supermomentum flux in Minkowski space, but since we're just using this variable to fix the frame, that should be okay. It's defined like this. And so if you use the Bianchi identities to kind of just manipulate this equation, what you find by just replacing psi 2 with the integral of its derivative is that this quantity, the Moresky supermomentum, is exactly equal to the energy flux. And so if you rewrite your shear in a transformed frame in terms of this Moresky supermomentum, now the entire dependence of the shear's transformation is simply governed by the Moresky supermomentum's transformation. And so this leads to the choice of a somewhat natural frame, namely the frame in which the supermomentum only has a non-temporal or a purely temporal component, where it's only equal to the Bondi mass, which is a constant over the two-sphere. And for these bound systems, because their memory is pretty much purely of this null type, by mapping to the super S frame, this corresponds to there being no instantaneous memory. So what that means is that if we end up with some super translated Kerr black hole, by mapping to the super S frame, we'll get back to just being Kerr. And perhaps the nicest thing about the Moresky supermomentum is that using this quantity, you can solve for the super translation that takes you to this desired frame using what's called the nice section equation. And so Dane and Moresky proved that for some condition that's always satisfied in the infinite past or the infinite future, this equation will always have a solution, and you can actually find this super translation parameter iteratively, which is incredibly nice for numerical purposes. Okay, so to summarize, the way we fix the frame, we fix the super translations using the Moresky supermomentum, we fix the center of mass freedom using the center of mass charge, and we fix the rotation freedom using the rotation charge. So kind of show what happens to that picture earlier, right? This is what we saw before, where the numerical waveform doesn't decay to zero. If we map to the super S frame, then we obtain this. So now you can see the numerical waveform decays to zero, and black hole perturbation theory does a much better job at fitting the numerical waveform. Okay. But when I talked about how BMS transformations change our shear, there were two effects, right? One that was this constant shift, and another that resulted from fixing your coordinates. And so it turns out that fixing your coordinates is actually incredibly important. So if we think about how that coordinate change affects our data, we had essentially terms that go as alpha times the news, which is the first time derivative of the shear. And so the largest mode in the supertranslation is the 2-0 mode, because that's a dominant memory effect. And the dominant mode of the news is 2-2. And if you think about how the 2-0 and 2-2 harmonics mix, the first harmonic that's excited is 3-2. So if we're looking for the biggest, the mode where this has the biggest impact, it should be the 3-2 mode. So this left column is just the numerical data as it is. Blue is numerical, orange is black hole perturbation theory, and this here is the residual between the two. This right-hand side is when we map to the super rest frame. And so the main thing to pay attention to is when you just change the waveform by a constant, which is this red curve, you essentially obtain the same residual as before. So you don't really see much of an improvement. But when you properly fix the BMS frame, not only changing your variables, but changing the coordinates, then you obtain much better agreement. So not only are these BMS transformations useful for transforming the variables, but it turns out that getting the right coordinates is also incredibly important. And this can be seen more generally. So here, I'm showing 13 different binary systems with different mass ratio and spin configuration. And for now, we can just focus on the top panel. So the important thing to pay attention to here is the height of each bar. The red bars are extrapolated waveforms. The light green bars are CCE when we just fix the Poincaré freedom. And the dark green bars are when we fix the entire BMS freedom. Here, we're looking at the mismatch between a numerical waveform and a QNM model over the entire two-sphere. And as you can see, by mapping to the super rest frame, we not only improve our mismatches in CCE by, you know, six orders of magnitude, but we're also always better than the extrapolated waveforms. And this should kind of make sense, because now we're just changing our waveforms so that they decay to zero. But if you look at this bottom panel, this shows the mismatch for the news waveforms, where there is no memory effect. And as you can see, by mapping to the super rest frame, we still see improvement in every type of simulation. And this is because now we're getting the coordinates correct. Okay, are there any questions on this? Okay, so.
I have a question.
Yes?
So, the top panel, is it just a constant, or is it just the spinning the constant, the added constant for the normal mode?
Yeah, so if you added a constant to the QNMs instead of the numerical waveform, you would essentially still have the same picture where you really don't do any better. So this would help with like the 2-0 mode. You would certainly have an improvement. But because mapping to the super S frame changes the coordinates as well, that also proves to be somewhat important. It's not nearly as important right here, maybe just a factor of 2 or so, but it still makes a difference. Okay, so this was the black hole perturbation picture. Now we can return to the post-Newtonian picture. And so for post-Newtonian waveforms, you can think of them as the super S frame in the infinite past. Namely, their Bondi mass aspect is constant, their shear goes to 0, and their Lorentz aspect is just of magnetic pair. That is, it's only rotational. But with our numerical simulations, we don't have data in the infinite past. We only have in-spiral. And so what you can do instead to map to the right BMS frame is you can map the numerical Moresky supermomentum to the PN Moresky supermomentum at some time during the in-spiral. But for this, you need to know what the PN Moresky supermomentum is, which has never been computed. But it turns out to be somewhat easy, right? If you have a PN expression for the strain, which we do, then you can just plug it into this equation and just keep things to the relevant PN order, and you actually obtain the Moresky supermomentum in a pretty straightforward manner. And this is kind of the result you obtain. So you don't have to pay attention to any of the numbers or values, but the things I'll say is, so the 0-0 harmonic, this is just the binding energy. And so when we do this computation, we get the exact same binding energy that you would normally get from PN. So according to the 0-0 harmonic, things look correct. The memory mode, like the 2-0 mode, this will just differ from the strain's memory mode by some numerical factor. And so if you compare this equation to the equation developed by Mark Favada, who was the first person to derive memory in a PN context, they're exactly the same. So this really builds up our confidence that we're doing things correctly. And then what's interesting is that using this formalism, we actually compute the spin-dependent memory to 2PN order for the first time without needing to take the PN metric itself to extremely high PN order. And there's also this cute effect where here there's a memory effect in the 3-1 harmonic, which is an example of what's called oscillatory memory, namely memory that shows up in a non-M equals 0. Okay. So now we have the PN Moresky supermomentum. We have spin-dependent memory terms in a PN formulation for the first time. So now we can compare our numerical waveforms to PN, and what we obtain is the following. So here, this is the same 13 systems. Yes?
Can you go back to the previous slide? So this
This is essentially the difference in the mass-weighted spins in the L direction, which for line spin systems is just the Z direction.
This is something you computed up to 2PN, so this piece is new, right?
Yep, the things with the star, so this is entirely new. This has never been computed before. This has been computed, but never identified as an oscillatory memory.
So, what was actually computed before for memory? So, let's see.
The spin memory, but this is the memory from black holes that are spinning. If the black holes have a spin.
Oh, yeah.
It's a little different. Right. Okay. So again, I just have the same 13 binary systems. Here I'm showing the relative error between a numerical waveform and a PN waveform over a 3-orbit window.
Sorry, can you explain the color code again? Which one is it?
Right. So the important thing is the height of the bars. The lower, the better.
The lower, the better.
Yeah. Red is extrapolated. So this was the old way of doing things. Light green is when we just fix the Poincaré freedom. So we don't do any super translations. And light green or dark green is when we fix everything. Okay. So as you can see, by mapping to the super S frame, we not only do much better than when we just fix the Poincaré freedoms. This is because we're accounting for that difference in the memory modes. But we're also, you know, two orders of magnitude better than extrapolated for the majority of these systems. So this is kind of the main result. Namely, if we want to do numerical simulations and compare to analytical or black hole perturbation theory, fixing the BMS frame is incredibly important.
So the residual error of the precession system is significantly higher than other cases you have an expectation.
Yeah, so part of the problem with processing systems is we only have them to 2 PN order in terms of the PN literature. And the memory ends up mixing into many of the other modes. So if you don't have memory to a high enough order, your agreement with precession ends up being worse. It also turns out, too, that the parameters you use to construct the PN waveform based on your quantities measured at the horizon aren't necessarily the best. And so there's some current work going on where you let those PN parameters be free and you optimize over them. And when you do that, you can actually obtain much better agreement with processing systems. So there seems to be some kind of disconnect between the parameters measured.
Well, they're not free, right? It's just unknown.
Right, but typically what's done is you take the values you measure in your numerical simulation and you just use those for the PN. But it turns out if you, you know, generate a bunch of different PN waveforms and see which one is best, it may not correspond to the same in-spiral parameters that you measure in your simulation. Okay, so this is kind of the end point for the main points I wanted to talk about. Seems like we have a bit of time, so perhaps I can show off some of the exciting things we've been doing.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is probably the most relevant. Now that we have these CCE waveforms, the problem is they're all private. And that's great for me, I can use them, but I want all of you to be able to use them too. So what we can do is we can build a surrogate model, which is essentially just because the data is private and we just haven't released it yet. But we're working on running CCE on all of our simulations, and then that'll all be public. I don't know the formalities of it. I just do the code. Yeah, or it's SXS private.
Yes, okay. And then there's a time frame where it's private, or it's like...
No, it's. I think part of the problem, too, is all that metric data is very large, so it would also just be hard to make public. And we just haven't had the time to run CCE to get the waveforms. They're small enough to actually publish. So it's a bit of a memory issue and maybe some logistics issue. Different kind of memory. Okay, so what we can do, right, to help the public understand what gravitational waves actually look like is we can build this surrogate model where you run like 100 simulations in a certain parameter space and you interpolate between the waveforms. So what we did is we ran simulations for mass ratio less than 8 and spin in the z direction whose absolute value is less than 0.8. And we used CCE waveforms. Now, the numerical simulations typically aren't long enough for LIGO, so you have to hybridize with PN. And so what we did is we took PN from an orbital frequency of 2 × 10⁻²⁴ to 20 orbits before merger, which is about 10⁵ orbits in total. We then performed a hybridization of NR and PN over a 3-orbit window at this 20-orbit point. And then the waveforms are numerical for the rest of in-spiral, merger, and ring dump. And to do this alignment with PN, we use this BMS frame fixing procedure, which I've been talking about so far. And so what we find is that the mismatches between the surrogate evaluation and the data used to train the surrogate are less than 2 × 10⁻²⁴ over this total mass range, which is relevant for LIGO. And so this is just a number, but kind of the important takeaway is that this is currently better than all existing models, and it has memory effects. So to kind of have some fun, I thought we could go ahead and generate some waveforms. If I can have two volunteers from the audience. Rena, okay. Or you can stay seated. You can just tell me the numbers you want. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so I need a mass ratio less than 8.
Okay, so from ratio?
1 to 8.
1 to 8, so 3.
3, okay, how about a spin? Between −0.8 and 0.8.
0.2.
Okay, and one more.
0.25.
Okay. Yeah, if you pick a corner case, then things will look a little weird, but we can still do it. Another volunteer?
Okay.
You can also just pick a random number, like, or tell me to do a random number and I'll do it.
Okay, what do you need?
A mass ratio between 1 and 8.
1 and 8, okay. Okay, 6.
Okay. And then a spin between negative 0.8 and 0.8?
0.5.
Okay, and one more.
We stick on negative 0.7.
Negative 0.7. Okay. So we wait a second, and then if I can get my cursor back over here. It's still going, and then. Okay, let me zoom in. So there's the first one, and there's the second one. So to kind of explain what's going on here, the top row is the 2-2 harmonic. Here it's just zoomed in. The second row is the 2-1 harmonic, and the third row, which is the most exciting bit, is the memory in the 2-0 mode. And so really, these waveforms are just an R until about this point, and everything before is all PN. So as you can see, you really can't see the difference between PN and an R. They kind of smoothly connect. And you know, here, it would be faster if I already had the surrogate loaded. But you generate once the surrogate is loaded, you can generate these waveforms in a fraction of a second. So we're working on writing a paper for this, and it should be out in the public in maybe a month or two.
So, what is the rationale for knowing how long you should run PN? Isn't just enough to run it just a little bit, and it's just enough because it just makes you feed the train?
Right. So the important thing is not necessarily this hybridization. The reason we run PN for so long is that's what LIGO needs. So LIGO needs the frequencies of that really early orbital frequency that goes down to 2 × 10⁴, just based on the total masses that they see. And so for future detectors like LISA, you need even longer. But for now, right now, we're not worried.
So this model doesn't have pre-processing?
This is not processing. Yeah. Processing is going to be a whole nother story, because typically what's done for processing is you map to the co-processing frame. But now that we have super translations, you have to not only map to a co-processing frame, you also have to map to a co-super translated frame, which is something we still have to figure out. That's in the future.
And you also have highly spinning.
Yeah, so 0.8 is, highly spinning probably mean like 0.998 or something like that. Yeah. So we can run CC on those specific simulations. We just currently don't have a surrogate.
So maybe you already mentioned, but how does this spin, the session, change your memory? Is it by a lot or small?
Yeah, so the memory effect itself, if you just look at the energy flux, it's going to be essentially the same. What ends up happening is that you just have a lot of mode mixing because of the changing orbital momentum. So you see like 2-2 frequencies in 2-0 kind of thing. But the memory itself, typically it's maximized when you have mass ratio 1, and it grows with spin. Yeah. Okay, so that was one exciting thing. Maybe I can briefly touch on the other exciting thing, which has to do with QNS. All right. So there's been all this talk in the QNM community about whether or not we're overfitting our numerical data. And people are always saying, well, why are things so linear, right? Mm-hmm. You have this violent black hole merger, you think things would be nonlinear. My answer is, well, obviously things are nonlinear, right? If you look at this 2-0 mode, typically people fit QNMs from 0 onward. And the energy flux goes as the nu squared. So immediately the energy flux is a nonlinear effect. Okay, so this is like, if you say that ring down is linear, I show you this, from 0 onward, this clearly evolves. And this is something that linear perturbation theory won't capture. Right, so this is an obvious example of a nonlinear effect. To make things a little more challenging, you can look at a mode which doesn't have this nonlinearity in the BMS context. So for example, you can look at the 4-4 harmonic. And so the reason 4-4 is interesting is if you think of a nonlinearity, specifically a quadratic interaction, from the ring down of 2-2 mixing with itself, the first harmonic it's going to excite is 4-4. So here, right, the 4-4 is shown in gray, the mass charge is in black, and you really don't see any of these nonlinearities, right? They're all essentially zero for this mode. And so what we did is, now that we can fix this BMS frame and understand what our ring down actually looks like, is we can consider two different QNM models. So the first one is linear. It involves the fundamental 4-4 mode and two overtones. So you just have, you know, an amplitude and then your frequencies. So this has three free parameters. The other model you can consider is a quadratic model, where you again have the fundamental mode, one overtone, and now this quadratic interaction, where the frequency is the frequency you would get from 2-2 fundamental mixing with itself, which if you just kind of look at how these exponents would add, this is just twice the fundamental 2-2-0 frequency. And so what we find is that if you just fit your numerical waveform with these first two terms, so the fundamental mode and the first overtone, and you let this third term have some freely varying frequency, and you compute the mismatch, then this is the contour plot you obtain. So here, the contours correspond to the mismatch, and the axes correspond to the real and imaginary parts of the frequency. And so what you find is that the mismatch is minimized pretty much exactly where this quadratic frequency is, whereas the second overtone is much farther away, nearly 2 to 3 orders of magnitude worse. So this is already kind of, you know, pretty indicative that this quadratic nonlinearity is present in the 4-4 mode. But the other thing you can do is you would expect the amplitude of this quadratic mode to scale quadratically with its parent mode, this fundamental 2-2. And so this is what this is trying to show. So each column is fitting the QNM to the NR waveform at a different start time, just increments of 5. The circles are remnants whose spin is 0.5, and the triangles are remnants whose spin is 0.7. And then the different colors correspond to a different mass ratio for the in-spiral system. And so what you see is that this quadratic amplitude, as a function of its parent mode, you know, pretty clearly follows a quadratic relationship. And if you work out the fits explicitly, the quadratic relationship is strongly favored over the linear relationship. This bottom row just shows the dependence of the fundamental 4-4 on the fundamental 2-2 as a reference. And this, you can see, is, you know, nowhere near related to this.
Sorry, so the final balance is different?
Yeah, so we included two different systems, or two different remnants, to essentially keep the remnant spin fixed for each subgroup, which also show two different examples.
But these symbols correspond to the same final balance spin.
Yeah, so all the circles have the same black hole spin of 0.5, and all the triangles have the same black hole spin of 0.7.
So they seem to follow the same line.
Yeah, so you would expect them to differ, you know, more. And so you do see some things happening, like, you know, here there's some difference between those points and maybe even down here. But for the most part, they seem to have some interesting trend where they're not that different. So then there's a lot of ongoing work where people are trying to explain, you know, what this relationship should be, and whether or not there's nonlinearities elsewhere. And that kind of wraps things up. So to just briefly summarize, we now have CCE waveforms with memory effects. You know, they have this problem with the initial data, but we can account for it by fixing the BMS frame. To do so, we needed the PN-Moresky supermomentum, which gave us some new memory terms in the PN strain. And it turns out that fixing this BMS frame is fairly straightforward, just using this kind of charge prescription. And it's very important for comparing to PN waveforms for building surrogate models, or comparing to black hole perturbation theory to find nonlinearities. And with that, I'll just reference some of the relevant papers, thank my collaborators, and thank the audience for their attention.
Any questions on the online? If not, any questions?
My understanding of this is that there is this super transformation and ambiguity of definition of angular momentum, and people are coming up with all different definitions. And recently, Formichan and others came up with a definition that you sort of integrate a quantity over two spheres and you do something super transformation invariant. How is that relevant for you?
01? Right. So the issue of the supertranslation ambiguity for angular momentum, right, is really only present if you're not explicitly stating how you're fixing these freedoms. And because we explicitly state how we're fixing this supertranslation, namely, like, for the remnant, we specify we want to be cur, not supertranslated cur, that's not necessarily a problem for us. What would be interesting, though, is to essentially compute the angular momentum suggested by those results and see how it compares to the normal Gray-Stroebel formulation throughout the entirety of our numerical simulation.
So if someone gives you a non-local definition of an angular momentum, is that going to help?
Right. Yeah. So I don't necessarily see any way it would directly help our work, but there could be interesting studies in the future just to see kind of what it looks like compared to other definitions. Yeah. But for us, as long as we specify how we're fixing our frame, then it's okay.
So in principle, should we rebuild all the EUV waveform that we have earlier?
Right. So the previous version of this surrogate, which was for extrapolated waveforms, they used an EOB phase correction. And so for this surrogate, we chose not to do that just because EOB is trained on extrapolated. And we don't know what kind of differences in the phase you might see between extrapolated. So in the long future, I would say EOB should certainly be trained on CCE instead. But it's not clear how important that necessarily is, right? Because it may be that if you train on extrapolated versus CCE, you don't necessarily see that big of a difference. So I would say in the future, yes, but for the time being, it's probably okay.
If I could chime in there. So I don't think EOB uses the 2-0 mode at all, right?
Yeah, that's right.
In the training.
I meant for, you know, whether or not the phase in other modes is modified.
But I mean, if they're not using the 2-0 mode in their training, they're using only inline spins, they're not really going to see any difference when they use CCE or extrapolated, right?
Well, that's the question. We haven't really necessarily done extensive checks to see how different CCE and extrapolated are for these other modes. They seem to be, you know, pretty much the same, but there are some people at Mississippi who are looking.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
So the previous papers are finding that it's for 7,000.
Right. Well, that's unclear. So they're the same authors are currently working on a new paper, where they essentially do some clever tricks to make things orthonormal and try to improve the fits, and kind of fit for free frequencies and see where they line up. I think it's leaning towards, there's still a lot of overtones, maybe not 7, but probably up to 3 or 4. So yeah, I don't want to make a full statement because I don't really know, but I think the general consensus is that maybe 7's too many, but it's unclear.
Thank you.
LIGO specifically? Yeah, I mean, I think the most convincing evidence is this recent result where people say spin memory, we should see it in 5 years.
Yes.
Right?
Sorry, I just put a paper, not 5 years. So COX3 COX3 is for running for 5 years, not 5 years.
Oh, it's COS, okay. Then it must have been displacement just for on LIGO.
Displacement is 5 years.
Okay, so it's on COSMIC for 5 years.
Yeah.
Okay. So in the future. Right. But I think what's really important, right, is without this understanding of the asymptotic symmetries and how they relate to these balance laws, I mean, here. Let me go back.
You have to wait for minutes and time, right?
Well, right, so the important thing is, oh, other slide. I mean, numerical relativity can spit out this green curve.
Yeah.
But if I give this green curve to LIGO and I say, hey, see if you see this green curve, they're going to see these orange oscillations. But what we want them to see is this green curve. And the only way to know what this green curve is going to look like is through this asymptotic understanding. So I would say where it comes important is we know what these effects are going to look like in numerical relativity, so we know what frequencies we're going to have, and that's what we can tell LIGO to look for. So that's the important thing.
I follow up on that. So, suppose the asymptotic symmetry community comes to you and tells you that there are more symmetries.
Yes. Well, people have done that, and it's a bit tricky, right? So, if I look at the symmetries we would expect from the generalized BMS group, where you kind of promote things further, or even there's these symmetries which Laurent has worked on, right, that essentially help you like recover Einstein's equations just from the symmetries themselves. And so, for example, there's this memory effect that, so displacement memory corresponds to psi 2, spin memory corresponds to psi 1, the bioscalars, and then there's this other memory effect that corresponds to psi 0. And so I can plot what that memory effect should be in two integrals of the string. It's non-zero, but since LIGO's only interested in the strain and we're just comparing the strain to PN or QNMs, currently we haven't seen a need to fix these extended symmetries.
Although that's true, but another thing that is true is that you might have a bigger symmetry, like global physical symmetry, way fixing frames.
Right.
And that's another effect, right? Because that's not only giving a stuff leading even in magnitude memory, which you are far from describing anyway.
Right.
But it may give you more resolution on the memory you already have. Instead, I'm reading what you are telling me.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
That's correct. So it could be that, you know, when we do this comparison to PN, right? So here it's clear we need a super translation.
Right.
But maybe we need a super rotation too.
Exactly.
The issue is that currently we know other problems. We know that, you know, our waveforms are a little eccentric. We know that they're not exactly equal mass. And so it's not obvious to us in the numerical community that we need super rotations. So if, you know, someone can say, hey, look, you get way better agreement between NR and PN if you apply a super rotation, then I'd be like, oh, okay, we need to figure out how to fix super rotations.
Interesting.
So my question, I don't need to take that super time, but, like, you know, go back to the original length of the so in that situation, the fact that the waveforms don't match with or without the AI saying this.
Oh, no, because the super translations are zero frequency, right? So LIGO's not going to see.
So, but the fact that you can, sorry, I guess what I'm asking is to what extent having waveforms that include the right tails are important or whatever, like obviously, like the waveforms that you're doing are matching better, but like the value of making sure that the waveform matches.
Yeah, so the experimentalists care, so like, right, we can apply a super translation to make these line up.
Yeah.
And then the way, right, what experimentalists care, they want a really long waveform.
Yeah.
And so we have to stitch these two together somehow. And so the more correctly you fix the frame, the smoother that stitching is going to be.
Okay, cool.
So you're not going to put in spurious effects that LIGO will see and say, oh, look at this. We see this frequency in your model, but like we don't see it in the data. And so the point of fixing the frame is to make that transition from analytical to numerical as smooth as possible.
Does that make something where
it helps? Oh, sorry. Yeah. I declare. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, if someone can say, hey, you get a smoother stitching with super rotations, I'll be like, awesome.
I just want something like
Yeah.
And in particular, you are also, maybe that's where the fact that you are finding this is rather a conformal infinity plays a role, because there's an enhancement of symmetries, asymptotic symmetry near the region at finite distance that you consider as an asymptote. But there's even more than just BMS double or anything.
Right. All right.
Even more bigger. So maybe that tells you that as you go to the left, bottom left, you're even more freedom to select the right frame that is really thick to the BN forward.
Right. And I am completely, you know, of the opinion that that probably will be the case one day. We just don't have the power to see it right now.
Okay, thanks. Yep.